Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Perspectives in Mental Health. This is a program where we explore various mental health points of view, appreciating how they overlap and contrast, and looking for ways to connect across them. This program is brought to you by MH Mediate, a mediation organization devoted to building more collaborative conversations in mental health. Today, we interview Dr. Eric Nessler, the Nash Family Professor of Neuroscience at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. Dr. Nessler serves as the chair of the Department of Neuroscience and director of the Friedman Brain Institute. The goal of Dr. Nessler's research is to better understand the molecular mechanisms of addiction and depression based on work in animal models, and then to use this information to develop improved treatments of these disorders. Dr. Nessler has also done consulting for Berg Pharma and is on the scientific advisory boards of Merck & Company Incorporated and Psychogenics Incorporated. Welcome, Dr. Nessler. We appreciate your taking the time to talk with us about your experiences and your work.
Thanks, Dan. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we'll start by educating our listeners about the work you're doing. Can you explain your research in layman's terms?
Sure. As you mentioned at the outset, we're interested in better understanding drug addiction and depression so that we can develop more effective treatments. And the way we approach this problem is in animal models involving mostly mice and to some extent rats, where we expose the animals, for example, to a drug of abuse and try to understand how drug exposure changes the brain to cause an addiction-like syndrome in the animals. And in a similar vein, in the area of depression, expose animals to different types of stress and see how stress changes the brain to cause depression-like responses.
Okay, great. And how does this relate to the conditions that we see in human beings?
It's always very difficult, particularly in psychiatry, to develop an animal model that's relevant to the human syndrome. You know, one can imagine, how can you tell a mouse or rat is addicted or depressed? And it's never possible to recapitulate an entire syndrome in an animal, but it is possible to recapitulate important aspects of it and then to derive meaningful information from those models. And I'll give you some examples. In the case of drug addiction, we can take a mouse or a rat and put it in a cage, and the mouse can have a choice to do a variety of things. It could get some food, it can play with another mouse, or it could press a lever to give itself cocaine. Turns out that all mice will press the lever because they're curious, interested in what it does, but actually a majority of the animals will press the lever, get some cocaine, but ignore it, not be particularly interested in it. A subset of the animals, maybe 20-30%, would like the cocaine enough to continue to press the lever. And a subset of those animals actually press the lever to such an extent that they forget about eating, they don't sleep well, they don't play with other mice, and some of them even overdose and kill themselves. And so we believe that having that kind of a behavior response to a drug like cocaine provides actually a pretty good animal model of drug addiction seen in humans. And in a similar vein, if we expose a mouse to different types of chronic stress, it's impossible to know whether the mouse has many cardinal features of depression. We will never know if the mouse is depressed, sad, guilty, suicidal, but the mouse does demonstrate many of the features of depression that are paramount in humans. So, for example, mice, like depressed humans, will show less interest in pleasurable activities, won't sleep right, won't eat right, won't interact right with other mice. And those behavioral abnormalities can be corrected with the same antidepressant drugs that work in humans. So we feel that in the area of depression also, it's possible to derive useful information about human depression by using mice and rats.
So my understanding in terms of measuring human depression is that that's still unclear as well in terms of figuring out if a person is experiencing depression or not, and classifying them as having different degrees of depression, the inventories we have for that are not perfect either. I don't know if that's your experience, and you can educate me if I'm misinformed, but I was wondering if maybe you can compare how robust our ability is to assess if some if a person has depression versus your animal models.
Absolutely.
Is that something you do or think about?
Yes, all the time. You are absolutely right. The diagnosis of all psychiatric illness in humans is limited. It's all based on talking to the patient or their families and assessing a range of behavioral abnormalities. Still today, there is not a single genetic test, brain scan, or blood test that helps make a diagnosis of depression or any other psychiatric illness. And that makes it extremely difficult to know when a person is depressed or not. And I'll just give you a few examples. A person walks into my office saying that they are depressed, and I need to make a diagnosis whether they have depression that's treated, for example, with psychotherapy or an antidepressant medication, or whether they're depressed because of normal life events, breakup of a relationship, death of a loved one, and that's normal in life, and people recover from those types of challenges. And there is no sharp distinction between normal sadness and clinical depression. So one is left with the hunch of a clinician trying to make that judgment. In my view, I think clinical depression is overdiagnosed. Many people with the diagnosis probably are just going through normal life events and need to find a way to cope with those events. But interestingly, in other populations, for example, in the inner city, where access to medical care is not as good, there are many people with clinical depression who probably are remaining undiagnosed and untreated.
So you said in your views, you qualify what you just said as people are being overdiagnosed based on your view. And one of the main focuses of this program is to educate people that there are multiple points of view out there. So
yep.
When you were clarifying that was your view, I'm wondering if you can just very quickly, because I don't want to focus too much on this, just explain, are there communities of clinicians who don't feel that people are being overdiagnosed?
I don't know. You know, the joke is that if you put 10 psychiatrists in a room, you'll get 11 opinions. And one of the difficulties is that there's no universally accepted or established criteria for diagnosis. And therefore, it is possible for two good psychiatrists to have differences of opinion. So I think that most people probably would agree with me, but perhaps not everyone.
Okay. And if you're doing research and you're trying to say something about depression and addiction through your animal models, are you creating your own definition of what qualifies as addiction and depression when you do that research? So that way you can say, this is the construct we're using today?
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, what a basic researcher like myself has to do is to identify an abnormal behavior in a rodent and understand what that represents for a human, with a very clear realization that what happens in a rodent is not going to be so clearly related to a human syndrome in such a clear-cut manner. So you have to be aware of the limitations of the animal models and only extract information from the animals that is justified.
Okay, and without getting into the details of any discrepancies that exist, I'm curious, are there different people doing research with animal models using different animal models? And having different methodologies for and debating what's the best way to extrapolate from a rodent to a person.
Absolutely. In fact, there's a very good example that came up recently in work that we've been doing in collaboration with Minghu Han's lab here at Mount Sinai and Carl Dicerroth at Stanford, where the various labs used two different types of stress models, one involving social stress and the other involving intermittent exposures to more physical stresses. For example, changing the light cycle of an animal, changing the temperature of the room the animal is in, things like that. And we found actually opposite effects of the two types of stress on the activity of a certain type of nerve cell in the brain that makes the chemical messenger called dopamine. So in the context of social stress, these dopamine-containing nerve cells showed greater electrical activity. In the context of the chronic, unpredictable stress, the dopamine cells showed the opposite changes in reduced activity. And in both cases, we were able to show that those changes were directly related to the abnormal behaviors exhibited by the animals. A major question then comes up is to now relate those findings to human depression or other stress-related syndromes. So one interesting idea is that the two types of stress in rodents represents also the many types of stress that humans face, whether it's traumatic stress in response to a horrendous event in a lifetime in combat or rape or sexual trauma, versus low levels of chronic social stress that people are subjected to in society and so on. And perhaps what we see in the animals represents differences that would also be seen in humans. Depression is not one thing. It's a combination of perhaps dozens of different disease entities. So the research now defines work to be done in humans to directly assess the activity of dopamine-containing nerve cells in human brain, which actually can be done now with brain imaging, in different types of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and so on, so that we can better understand what the animal models are telling us.
Great. So I want to ask you one more question about your research, and then I want to focus the second half of the interview just about you educating listeners of what's going on in the research community and how the research process works and how you interact with other communities when explaining your research. And so the question I have to ask you because of the title of this program is, how does this relate to genes?
Yes. So we believe that the changes in gene expression are important control points for very long-lasting changes in behavior. The way I think about it is by analogy to the gym. You go to the gym, you exercise your muscles, the genes that encode proteins that determine the strength and size of single muscle fibers are turned on by using a muscle. So over time, with exercise, your muscle gets bigger. That's through changes in gene expression. In a very similar way, learning and good memory occurs by experience-induced changes in gene expression in the brain that make certain nerve cells and connections between them stronger. However, there are also changes in gene expression that are not adaptive, that they are maladaptive, they hurt a person. And so that in some individuals, exposures to a drug of abuse or distress over a period of time will induce similar types of changes in gene expression in parts of the brain, but in this case, those changes in gene expression cause long-lasting pathology.
Okay, great. And so what you're saying is, you know, a popular misconception might be that you're born with certain genes and there's nothing you can do about it, those are your genes. But in fact, your genes can be expressed in different ways based on certain behaviors.
Absolutely. So it's true that the gene sequence, the DNA sequence that represents our genes, is essentially immutable from birth. We're born with our genetic constitution. But throughout life, our experiences and exposures constantly modify the ability of those genes to produce their functional effects. And that's why identical twins who have the same exact DNA sequence can be so different, particularly if they're raised in different circumstances and exposed to different things throughout life.
And so your work is at least in part focused on changing those circumstances to see which ones will yield better or worse gene expression.
That's right. And so as just one example, we can take a group of animals that are genetically identical, essentially all identical twins, and expose them to the same level of social stress and show that about half of the animals will succumb to the stress and develop depression-like symptoms. For example, they lose interest in pleasurable activities like drinking sugar water, eating a high-fat food like a Reese's Pieces, or having sex, whereas the other half of animals exposed to the same range of stresses can somehow find a way to cope more adaptively and avoid those deleterious consequences. We call those animals resilient.
And you're asking for how do we... I'm sorry, what were you saying?
No, I was just going to add that we are now... So we are looking for the different ways in which the nerve cells in the brain change their gene expression in a susceptible animal versus a resilient animal to determine those two very different endpoints.
That sounds very fascinating. So I want to shift gears now to explaining the research process to the listeners to the program so people can start to understand what it really means to do research and how you interact with different stakeholders along the way.
Sure.
Please, if you could explain the research process from start to finish and really highlight the different people that you're interacting with, whether it's funding sources or academic institutions or other researchers.
Okay. Research very much depends on everything that's occurred previously. So every experiment that has ever been done in my lab has depended in great extent on work that has been done by others, sometimes over several decades. So we would by looking at the available information, we would come up with a new idea, perhaps illustrating a new mechanism involved in addiction or depression, and then set out to test it in animals. Typically, when a person just starts to do research, the institution where they're working will give them what are called startup funds, funds to do initial experiments. Doing the experiments is highly collaborative. It involves work done by many people together in a very integrated, coordinated manner. As the results or data are obtained, further experiments are performed to obtain additional information about those original ideas. When you get a certain amount of information that's cohesive and is beginning to tell us something new, providing some new insight about depression or addiction, it then becomes time to write grants. And typically, new faculty will write smaller grants to private foundations where not so much data is needed. As a lab grows and matures and gets more data, they can write a longer grant and apply to the National Institutes of Health, which provides 95% plus of all the funding available for biomedical research in the country. As you get the grants, it makes it possible to... No, I was just going to say, as you get those grants, then you have the funding to further expand the kind of work that you're doing.
So if the academic institution is providing those startup funds and then the funders are providing the grants, and just for anyone who's confused who's listening, when we say that someone's writing a grant, that means they're applying for the money and they're being
Correct.
Going to receive that grant money from somewhere else. Because I know that's the way people talk about fundraising, but anyone who's not in that world of getting grant money might not understand that you're not
Yep.
writing – you're not giving anyone money. You're asking for money when you write a grant.
That's correct.
So this process of looking for funding, does that ever influence the path of the research?
It does. There's, to a certain extent, and I think it's probably, roughly 50-50, investigators have interests, are driven by what they believe in their heart and mind are the important questions to ask about a certain disease. But the NIH or other funding agencies, private foundations, can most certainly influence the direction of a field by providing money in a targeted manner. For example, a new foundation could arise focused on autism, and by announcing the availability of grants to study autism, they will pull people into that field. And I think it works pretty well. I think it's a good mix currently, because it's important not only for funding agencies, it's important that funding agencies don't solely drive the process, that the enterprise, the nation's research enterprise also benefits from the expertise and experience of its scientists.
Great. I'm also curious, outside the research community and these foundations, there's a lot of different advocacy groups in the world of mental health. One example would be the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I've done a lot of work looking at these different communities. I'm wondering how those communities interact with you, if they do at all.
We interact quite a bit. Not only NAMI, which you mentioned, but many others focused on a whole range of illnesses in psychiatry and neurology. And these, what are, you know, advocacy groups or consumer groups, are extremely important for the country. The researchers themselves are the ones who can do the research, but it's the advocacy groups that are needed in several ways. First, we need the advocacy groups to create the case for the nation to support research in this area. I believe, as many of us do, that our nation's support of research for mental illness is not sufficient, that if you look at the impact of mental illness on society, it's far greater than the dollars it gets from NIH compared, for example, to cancer and heart disease. And I think that is because it's been harder for to advocate on behalf of the mentally ill than it is on behalf of cancer and heart disease. And the advocacy groups in recent years have really stepped into that void and improved the situation by impressing upon Congress and the people that it's that we need more research in mental health.
Great. And have you had personal experiences speaking with people from any of the groups, or is it more of a you're aware that your work is helping?
Yeah, so in fact, absolutely. And I only gave one of several ways in which advocacy groups are important. Advocacy groups are also important because they provide an important vehicle where through which researchers can educate the people with these various illnesses and vice versa. So, for example, I've given many talks at NAMI events and other events sponsored by other advocacy groups where I talk about my research and at the same time tether my research to the real world by hearing about their problems.
That's great. Another question I have, you know, like I said, the focus on this program is to really show people that there's different perspectives out there. And so one question I'm interested in is, are there people whose research findings clash with yours? And how does that happen in academia? You know, how do people debate whose research is right?
That happens all the time. We view it actually as a positive aspect of science. The example I gave you of two different types of stress causing opposite effects on dopamine-containing nerve cells is a great case in point. We came together, realized this difference, and are now trying to understand the basis of that difference. When scientists obtain discrepant findings, it's actually a crucially important part of the scientific process because it will help us reveal more of the underpinning mechanisms. You know, some people in the field don't take it so positively, but I think the vast majority of people respond positively and integrate different viewpoints.
That's great. So one thing I wanted to mention about that, just to get your thoughts on it, is I feel like there's a popular misconception that we have a lot of facts that are robust about even things like the prevalence of mental illness or how these illnesses are happening, or people get very firm in the idea there's a chemical imbalance in the brain and that's what's causing an illness, and they seem to think things are figured out. And I'm wondering, when people are debating the research finding, are they talking from a place where they think they figured it out, or are they talking from a place where you know, everyone's sort of agreeing that we're making best guesses, but we have no answers?
I think everyone would agree that this is a work in progress. So I've had a lab now for 26 years, and we have learned an enormous amount about the brain over 26 years and are beginning now to apply that increased knowledge to mental illness. So there are certain things we clearly know. We know that most forms of mental illness are highly heritable. More heritable, for example, than cholesterol or blood pressure. So mental illness is highly genetic, and now for the first time we're actually beginning to identify the specific genes that contribute to an individual's risk for a mental illness. And we're beginning to understand how those genes affect the brain in ways to cause the illness. So we don't have the answers yet. We are learning a lot. And where the field is now is to increasingly take this knowledge to find ways to develop better diagnostic tests and also better treatments.
And in the realm of better treatments, you know, it struck me that your work seems to be focused on if someone does have a gene, it doesn't necessarily have to express. So when you say the genes are heritable, it sounds like it's also a complex of the genes and the behaviors that lead to that inherited gene to be expressed. Is that correct?
Yes.
So is that something that you look for in treatment, or are you? Or is
yes,
it,
absolutely.
Are people
it's very
genetic screening.
Yes, it's very possible. We work with our clinical colleagues who are looking to identify these genes in humans with different mental illness, forms of mental illness, and then in animal models looking for ways to influence the impact of those abnormal genes or genetic variations on behavior. Because even an individual, animal or human, with the abnormal gene or the risk-causing variant of the gene might not show the risk, and we are looking for ways to modify the impact of those genes on behavior. So that's very much an area of great interest.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you a controversial question you probably won't be able to answer, but do you think that the treatments will move towards screening out people who have that gene so they aren't, you know, like genetic screening when, you know prenatal and testing to make sure that those people don't wind up being born with that gene, or even the treatments are going to go more toward figuring out ways to regulate that gene so it doesn't become a problem?
I think in the vast majority of cases it will be the latter, because mental illnesses, almost all of them, are not caused by single genes that could be tested for example, like Down syndrome. Mental illness, whether it's schizophrenia, depression, or bipolar disorder, or autism, are likely caused by, in a given individual, even hundreds of genes in a single person. And with that complexity of genetic underpinnings of an illness, the best approach would be to figure out ways to mitigate the genetic risk, which we think could be done, so that you have a person with the risks but remains healthy for their lives because of avoiding certain challenges or doing things that are positive to promote health.
That's very inspiring. I hope that's correct. And so we have 2 minutes left. My last question is, and I guess it'll have to be brief from you, what inspired you to pursue mental health in the first place?
Well, it goes back to when I was in medical school. I was very much undecided what medical field to go into. In the third year of medical school, students rotate around different fields of the hospital. And when I did psychiatry, I fell in love with it. I enjoyed working with people with mental illness, and particularly challenged by thinking about what was going on in their brains to lead to the problems that they faced in life, and something I've devoted my career to since.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today and explain more about what you do and the different perspectives involved in research.
My pleasure.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.